Welcome to our next lecture in Western Civilization 1. This week we're going to talk about Octavian and the Pax Romana. So what we're going to address is the figure of Octavian, or Caesar Augustus, who dominates this period of time, and the empire that he built, that really he laid a foundation for the empire remaining for many, many centuries to come. So let's get into it. Julius Caesar's assassination was most likely, most people consider, a huge mistake because it ushers in 10 years of civil war. And most people now admit that the Republic was long dead before Caesar came to power. The Constitution had been ignored or brushed under the rug for far too long, and it was time for a new order. So Gaius Octavius was the great nephew of Julius Caesar, and posthumously, after Caesar's death, he was declared Caesar's heir, his adoptive son. Which, by the way, I should mention that in the ancient world, adoption was primarily something you did for an adult child. They did not really have the notion of adopting a baby. A man would adopt an adult man as his son to be the heir to his estate if he had no male children. So, Octavius emerges as a very important figure, and because he's a Caesar, he has the loyalty of Caesar's army, which is very important. Any emperor worth his salt needs an army behind him. So in 43, he forms the second triumvirate with Antony and Marcus Lepidus. They wanted to consolidate power and to overcome senatorial opposition. In other words, to get rid of all the conspirators who had killed Caesar. So the triumvirate is able to do this. They eventually beat Brutus and Cassius, who were the ringleaders, more or less, of the senatorial conspiracy. and they defeat them at the Battle of Philippi. Then the remaining the members of the triumvirate divide the empire up. Antony took over the east, where he became quite powerful and influential, and Octavian took over the west. And while Octavian is in the west, he has the ear of the Senate. He has the sort of the press organ of Rome. He can sort of spin Antony's reputation back in Rome. He had to do a lot of things. He was doing a lot of things. He was quite busy. He confiscates public lands and gives it to his retired soldiers, sort of settling a long-standing debate there. He built strong loyalty, therefore, with the soldiers and the Italian politicians at home. So he has sort of two bases of power, the army and the Senate. Now, Antony married Octavian's sister, kind of as a political move, but as we've discussed before, he openly conducted an affair with Cleopatra, the last of the Ptolemaic pharaohs, with whom he had a child. And so Octavian can play on the traditional suspicion of anything Greek or anything Eastern, anything basically non-Roman, to make everyone suspicious of Antony and set all the sentiment at home against Antony. Antony also seemed to really make a lot of mistakes here. He had a child with Cleopatra, and he allowed that child to be hailed as royal, which is sort of a threat to senatorial power. So eventually they engage in battle. Interestingly, Herod, the Herod from the Bible, is sort of in Israel at the time, in Judea, trying to finagle power, and he makes the mistake of siding in this conflict with Antony over Caesar, over Augustus. Well, Antony is beaten. Antony and Cleopatra are beaten. Cleopatra famously kills herself with the snakes, Antony with a sword, and Herod is left in this position of having supported Caesar's enemy. He presents himself to Caesar, lays his crown at his feet, and says, "Well, don't consider whose friend I was, in other words, I was Antony's friend, but consider what kind of friend I can be." Well, Augustus says, "Well, this is compelling," and he gives Herod his crown back, and Herod saves his own skin, and they actually have a long-standing relationship where Caesar Augustus supports Herod. Caesar Augustus will note, however, when Herod is in the middle of purging suspicious members of his family, killing his sons, among other things. Caesar says, "I would rather be Herod's pig than his son." So he supported him, but he also looked questioningly at a lot of Herod's life. Well, now Octavian is the undisputed ruler of the Roman world at the age of 33. At the age, more or less, that we think Jesus was crucified and raised from the dead, Caesar emerges as the most powerful emperor in the world. Remember, I mentioned that the incarnation took place during his reign. Caesar's going to rule for another 44 years, okay, from 33, the age of 33, till the age of 77. And he's got a lot that he needs to do. He had to settle and secure the loyalty of the army that was very big and very disgruntled. He had to deal with the unsecure European borders. He had to deal with the perennial class conflict in the city of Rome itself, the rich against the poor. And he had to build basically a monarchy that didn't look like a monarchy, because remember, the Romans don't like monarchies. They don't like kings. This is deep in their political DNA to not like kings. So he's got a lot that he has to do. He creates an empire of a constitutional sort. It is an empire, but it has something of a constitution. And his ascension to the imperial throne ushers in what historians have called the Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, a period of time of relative peace and prosperity. Now, keep in mind, this is Rome, and if you defy Rome, you can be violently put down. And there are many people who are violently crushed during this time. Probably most famously, this is after the reign of Caesar Augustus, but the Jews in Jerusalem are put down violently in 70 AD. So it is the peace of Rome, but they definitely enforce the peace with the sword. So Caesar does many things. He retires his soldiers in far-off lands that are a part of Rome's empire, and this does several things. Number one, those soldiers are happy because they have land. Number two, it settles people loyal to him in the outskirts of the empire, thus ensuring some kind of stability and solidarity. The city was another matter, city of Rome itself. There's great poverty, in part because the slaves have all the jobs, and there's not much for poor people to do. Very few poor people have jobs that they can make a living with. So the emperors do all kinds of public works to try to appease the masses, sort of free public services to try to keep any resentment or frustration at bay. So they create aqueducts. Roman aqueducts are an absolute marvel of engineering. They were able to take water only using the power of gravity, sometimes 60, 100 miles from the source, and bring fresh water. And what's more interesting to me is that sometimes they were able to, if you think about it, these aqueducts had to have a downward grade the whole time. And sometimes the grade is incredibly subtle. It's amazing that they were able to calculate and get this kind of subtlety. But sometimes the aqueducts actually had to go uphill like a roller coaster, and the Romans engineered used really incredible tricks of physics to get water to go uphill. So these aqueducts were really remarkable. They build public baths, which are sort of public. Oh, they're places of recreation, they're places of socializing, they're places of sort of decadent prostitution. There's all kinds of things that go on in these baths. And of course, they build arenas, the most famous being the Colosseum, where public sporting events could take place. And these public sporting events were a big strategy that later emperors used to entertain the populace into passivity. The Colosseum itself in Rome could seat 50,000. It could be flooded down below to allow for the depiction of mock sea battles. It was really an astounding place. So there's all these public works, again, that are meant to try to pacify a very boisterous and frustrated poor public in the city of Rome itself. Augustus enacts religious reforms. He does this for two reasons. One, he wants to bring traditional Roman piety back, traditional Roman religion, because he believes it's key to stability in his empire. He's not going to be the first nor the last emperor who realizes religion is key to keeping peace and prosperity. He also brings religious reforms to establish his own cult or special devotion to him as a living god. In fact, he takes the title Soter, S-O-T-E-R, which is of Greek origin, and it means savior. And savior in this context meant the guy who brings prosperity and political peace. He is claiming that under his rule and power, Rome is given the peace and security that they have so longed for. He engages on a campaign to reinvigorate the traditional family, which should tell you that the traditional family is in decline. The sort of sexual decadence of emperors after Augustus is astounding. It is really unbelievable, some of the depravity that many of these emperors descended to. Augustus is probably working an uphill battle here to try to bring back traditional values. But he really puts forth a valiant effort. He strengthens the power of the paterfamilias. He creates new punishments for female extramarital affairs. By the way, consider Dido as a negative example of a woman who failed to keep her marital vows. Now, granted, she was a widow, but nonetheless, this idea that she should have remained faithful to her deceased husband is very strong, and Virgil, or the emperor through Virgil, is trying to cultivate that. As we've indicated before, Caesar patronizes many different authors who celebrate traditional Roman values, but in particular Horace and Virgil, because he saw them holding up the ancient models of Roman piety. As we've discussed and as you're reading, Virgil glorifies in the golden age of Augustus's reign, the golden age of Rome. We have the story of Aeneas driven by loyalty to the gods and loyalty to his family and not self-seeking like Odysseus. It is a pretty blatant reworking of Roman history that winds up being very successful. I mean, it goes down as one of the greatest epics, greatest pieces of literature out of Rome. And of course, there's some famous lines, one of which is Anchises in the underworld. Aeneas goes there to meet with his father, and his father prophesies to him of the future of Rome. And he says this: "Let others fashion in bronze more lifelike, breathing images. Let others, as I believe they will, draw living faces from marble. Others shall plead cases better, and others will better track the course of the heavens and announce rising stars. But remember, Romans, your task is to rule the peoples. This will be your art, to teach the habit of peace, to spare the defeated, and to subdue the haughty." This is a great example of what Rome did, what Rome became, what Caesar understood Rome's job to be, with himself at the head. So Caesar is really amazing in many of the things he did. He takes many, many titles. He is known probably most for the title Augustus, which means it's a religious title, and it means something like reverend, one who is consecrated by religion. And so it is a very important title. And it is the one that, again, history records, or that we remember him the most by. So, Caesar's reign goes from 31 BC to 14 AD, 31 BC being the Battle of Actium. So, some more things about his reign. We've already indicated that Christ was born during his reign. He ushers in the golden age of Rome. He is the princeps or first among his people, but not king, not called king at any rate. He restored some measure of order and stability to the empire, and he spreads the Latin language all throughout the Mediterranean. And Rome is going to settle down for about 200 years into a time of peace and prosperity. He had something like 60 legions, as I mentioned, and he retires almost half of them into conquered lands, as we indicated before. I should also mention at this point some of the religions. Maybe one of the most important religions at the time in Rome actually was a kind of it was a kind of philosophy more than anything, and this is the Stoics. The Stoics believed that it was the height of one's wisdom to know one's duty and then do it, and not to pursue self-interest. Well, this should sound awfully familiar because this is, after all, what Aeneas did and what Caesar, I guess, thought he was doing and what he expected every good Roman to do. The Stoics also had the interesting belief in something called the Logos. They believed the universe was ordered by God, a god, and that this order, one of the high gods, and that this order is the Logos. It's the rational way the universe is put together. And everyone had a role to play in the universe, and their job was to submit to that role and not try to make their own way, create their own identity. And the Logos oversaw all this. Now, the Logos is interesting because it's going to come up again later in Christian thinking in the Gospel of John. Jesus is called the Logos. We have also mentioned some of the values of the empire. I want to mention or reiterate three very important values that Augustus supported and promoted. One was pietas, that we've mentioned already. We could translate it as piety, we could translate it as propriety, we could translate it as respect for authority, the authority of prior generations. And respect for the gods of Rome. Virtus, manliness, Virtus, manliness or fortitude in the face of adversity. this really does go back to Rome's republican roots. Think of the tough farmer who endures hardship to bring forth crops and provide for his family and provide for the state. And think of how Aeneas exhibits virtus, how he represents that unrelenting devotion to the task put before him. And finally, officium or officium, spelled kind of like office, Officium. And we could translate this as duty. Once again, remember that Aeneas is not supposed to pursue his wishes or his desires or his wants. But he is supposed to give himself to his duty, to found Rome and really lay the groundwork for guys like Caesar Augustus years later. Now, I mentioned before that Virgil was patronized, in other words, the emperor supported him, but the emperor also sort of banished and censored poets that he did not like. So, for example, there was a poet named Ovid, who Well, I can't put it any other way. He wrote a book on the art of seduction, on the art of seducing a married woman into an affair. Well, for Augustus's reforms and his plans, this was bad. Okay, this was cutting against the family. And so he even sort of mocks Virgil. So you can imagine, The kind of way we might mock a Captain America for being goody-goody. Well, Ovid did this. So the emperor says, well, enough of that, and he exiles Ovid to the Black Sea. And remember, this is before the days of the internet or the printing press, so it's kind of hard for him to get word out about this. So, all in all, Caesar is able to secure the borders of Rome. He is able to cultivate a new sense of patriotism, to grow the economy. He is able to improve administration on the borders of the empire. But he had great difficulty in choosing a successor. The first several of his choices died before he did. That won't work. And after several attempts, he eventually picks a stepson to be the successor, and we'll get into this in the coming weeks. But the bottom line is Caesar was never able to provide himself an immediate male heir, which is kind of ironic because he was a very powerful emperor, but he could never really provide an heir. And most heirs to the empire are going to be pretty unsatisfactory, as you'll see. So Augustus dies in the year 14 AD at the age of 76. I believe I said 77 before. On his deathbed, it is said that he asked if he played his part well in the comedy of life. Seems like something somewhat of a cynical statement. Other than a civil war in 69, there was peace and relative prosperity after this for about 200 years. He has established a whole lot of peace and prosperity. And you could say that much of the stability of the empire for years to come is going to be based on his personality. 44 years really lays the groundwork for an example that lasts for a long time. After Augustus, there will be violent succession between the emperors. The ultimate dynasty that gets established are through the children of his wife, Livia, and his daughter Julia. This is known as the Julio-Claudian line, and we will get into that in the weeks to come. But the main thing to keep in mind is the really amazing achievements of Caesar Augustus and his very long reign.